Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. On each episode, we'll talk with a biographer about his or her work.
Today, we welcome David Greenberg, who is the author of John Lewis, A Life. And it's a new biography that came out in October. And for those who think they know a lot about John Lewis, it's going to let us know that there's a lot more to learn. So welcome, David. And can you maybe say a little bit about what you think people can learn about John Lewis that they don't already know?
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. Thank you for having me on. I was surprised how much more there was to learn, for me to learn, as I was researching John Lewis's life for the last 5 years or so. You know, people probably know the stories of his heroism and courage during the civil rights movement. He was there at the sit-in movement when he was just a college student in 1960. Spoke at the March on Washington, the youngest speaker at age 23, famously confronted George Wallace's troopers at the bridge at Selma and got beaten badly in an act that helped bring about the Voting Rights Act. And of course, people know his many years in the Congress, but his life is much richer and fuller and more complicated. You know, there's a lot in this book about his wife, Lillian. You know, she died several years before he did, but really kept out of the limelight, but was a very important force in his career. There's a lot in his years between the civil rights movement and entering politics that people will learn about. People may not know that for 7 years in the 1970s, he was basically the Stacey Abrams of his day, you know, before Stacey Abrams was even born, crisscrossing the South to get millions of Black voters registered in the wake of the Voting Rights Act. I think people will learn a lot about him personally. You know, he was a tremendous collector of African-American art, for example, and got to know some of the world's greatest Black artists like Jacob Lawrence and Romare Bearden. People will learn about his friendships, his personal quirks, the way he ran his office, the way he climbed the ranks of Democratic leadership in the House. I think there's a lot in here that will help show John Lewis not just to be this kind of celebrity and saintly figure that we know him to be, but a real full-fledged three-dimensional human being with many wonderful endearing qualities, with some traits or decisions he made that sometimes others objected to or criticized. You know, he was far from perfect. And that really show him in all his full humanity.
He grew up on a farm in Alabama. And how does he get from there to being a major figure in the civil rights movement at a very young age?
It's kind of an amazing story. And kind of all the more surprising because as a boy and a young man, and even as a congressman, he was an incredibly humble and self-effacing person. He wasn't someone who ever put on airs or put himself forward. And yet he seems to, you know, even as a boy, have had certain natural leadership qualities. You know, for one thing, he really felt the sting of the Jim Crow white supremacist order of the Old South, of the, you know, pre-1965 South. While, of course, his brothers and sisters and his parents felt that too, not everybody felt it incumbent upon themselves to challenge it, to try to tear it down. And John Lewis, you know, one time as a boy, he's a voracious reader. You know, another kind of interesting fact about him. He loved reading biography and literature. And he went to the Troy, Alabama Public Library to get a library card and was denied because of his skin color. And what does he do? He organizes a petition with his brothers and sisters and cousins and friends to demand that, you know, they open up the library to Black kids as well as white kids. But of course, it doesn't go anywhere. But it's a sign that early on, he wants to fight this institutionalized racism. And so that streak is in him, even as a boy. His parents believed in education. They were not well educated in any formal sense themselves, but they want him to go to college. And his mother, who besides working on the farm, also works as a washwoman at different institutions, brings home a brochure that includes an ad for a place called American Baptist Theological Seminary in Nashville. And John Lewis, who's already a young minister at the age of 16, applies there. I was able to find his college application and acceptance letter, and he's welcome to American Baptist. They even tell him, "We hope it's in God's plan that you come and study here." And maybe it was, if people are so inclined to believe, because it's in Nashville at American Baptist that things are really fermenting in the fight for equal rights, in the fight for racial equality. And John Lewis falls in with a group of social gospel ministers, people who, much in the style of Martin Luther King, you know, are trying to apply the teachings of Christ, but also the teachings of Gandhi, nonviolent civil disobedience, to bringing down segregation and racial discrimination across the South. They have workshops, they have study groups. So he really steeps himself in the world of this nonviolent movement. And from a very young age, he's becomes a central part of it. The Nashville movement becomes one of the most successful groups of all the college student groups that are staging sit-ins at lunch counters across the South. This is in 1959, 1960. The whole sit-in movement to go to the Five and Dimes, the Woolworths, McClellan's, to sit in interracial groups at the lunch counters until these establishments finally agree to allow Blacks to sit there on an equal basis with whites.
One of many important contributions in that the sit-in movement, the dominant narrative typically starts with Greensboro, North Carolina.
Right.
But Nashville, they were doing that even before. And probably in a more ideologically grounded way because of their training. So the impression I got is that Greensboro is important, but without that Nashville predecessor, there might not have been the momentum that occurs. Is that accurate?
No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, taking nothing away from the young men in Greensboro who really are the first ones in February 1960 to do their own sit-ins. The Nashville group has been planning it for quite some time, and they're a little surprised to see these headlines coming out of North Carolina because they've been planning to do much the same thing, just hadn't quite kicked into operation yet in early 1960. So the call goes from Douglas Moore, who's a minister who's close to the kids in Greensboro, to James Lawson, who's the Vanderbilt Divinity student who's advising and teaching the students in Nashville. And he says, you know, can you help us out? And Lawson is ready to go. And Lawson's group, you know, much more than any other groups, had been studying for months. They had been practicing, doing workshops where they would harass each other and shout racial slurs at each other and beat each other up even, in an effort to prepare themselves for what they might encounter when it came time to do these sit-ins. And it's a Nashville group that is the largest, that has the most immediate success that spring in achieving desegregation, and that goes on to sort of provide a lot of the core people like John Lewis, Diane Nash, James Bevel, Marion Barry, who, when SNCC is formed, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, later that spring, the Nashville people are a key part of it because they're trained and they have this really burning commitment to fight this fight.
And that kind of opens up another important phase for John Lewis, in that eventually he becomes a leader, even though, like you said, he's not somebody who's trying to jump out front. But what about him, do you think, leads to him becoming chairman of SNCC.
I think Lewis has, maybe not the most striking qualities we see in leaders. There are other people like Marion Barry or Julian Bond who were confident, charismatic, had some swagger. John Lewis didn't have that, but he was someone who people quickly came to see. He wouldn't be the first one to speak, and he might not speak at all in a given meeting. But when he spoke, it was always something thoughtful, profound, and wise. He also had a quality, a deep commitment to the ideals of nonviolence, the whole Gandhian set of principles known as Satyagraha, where nonviolence was not just a tactic that you used to gain favor through media attention. If you got beat up and didn't hit back, that would help win sympathy. I mean, that was part of it. But for Lewis, it was a way of life, a philosophy that you really had to try to deeply believe in the possibility of redemption for your assailant, for your enemy, for all of society. And I think that the trueness, the purity of that belief was something people recognized in John Lewis. And in 1963, people sometimes know the story of Nashville in 1960 with the lunch counters. What they don't necessarily know, and there's a lot about this in my book, is for the next 3 years, after the cameras go away, after the reporters go away, Lewis continues to fight, sometimes with just a very small group of comrades, for the more thorough desegregation of Nashville. Not just those lunch counters, but other restaurants, movie theaters, swimming pools, and so forth. A lot of that finally gets achieved in the spring of 1963. And I think that success makes the leadership of SNCC, mainly James Forman, who was the executive director and was about 10 years older than the mostly quite young people in SNCC, it makes them turn to John Lewis and say, he really should be our public face, our chairman. And so in 1963, at the age of 23, he is elevated to this very prominent national position, speaks at the March on Washington, and really becomes a national leader in the fight for civil rights.
You touched on the phase when he's with the voter education program, which I had never heard of before. And you mentioned that he's the Stacey Abrams of his time. Can you maybe talk about why that's so important in terms of what he goes on to do?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think sort of just to back up for a moment, I hope readers will find in this book, a lot of rich new material about the civil rights era and, the Freedom Rides and Selma and the Mississippi Freedom Summer. They'll find a lot about his years in Atlanta politics, a lot about Congress. But this chapter about leading the voter education project really is not well known at all. This was a group that had actually been organized with help from the Kennedy Justice Department back in the early 60s. Initially, John Lewis didn't like the thought of it. He thought the Kennedys were trying to steer him and his friends away from direct action confrontation techniques like the Freedom Rides and into this kind of safer business of voter registration. But especially after Selma and the passage of the Voting Rights Act, Lewis really comes to see the importance of the vote, and that becomes sort of his lifelong mantra. I mean, we can all probably remember him in those last years imploring everybody to get out and vote and reminding how important it is. Even after African Americans in the South were granted the vote, many of them still did not take advantage of it. Some of it was there was still continuing discrimination, illegal discrimination. Some of it was also a kind of learned passivity that people who their whole lives had been told they had to stay away from the polls, just found it hard to change habit and say, yes, now I can exercise that vote. So Lewis, for 7 years, often with his friend Julian Bond at his side, crisscrosses the South, going into churches and pool halls and union halls, explaining to people the importance of taking advantage of this democratic instrument. They give out grants. They work with newly elected African American leaders in local offices. It's a big, important organization that, unfortunately, soon after John Lewis leaves the leadership, falls on hard times. And so that's probably why people don't know it today. But in its day, they registered, I think, 3.5 million Blacks around the South. And when Jimmy Carter is elected president in 1976, it's on the strength of Black votes in the South. You know, it's an interesting electoral map to look at and see all these Southern states going Democratic. And they did so with a mix of, you know, more moderate or liberal whites and millions of Black votes. And John Lewis takes pride in that. He says, the hands that picked cotton have now picked our president. And it really was transformational work. It transformed the nature of the Democratic Party and it transformed the American electorate.
He's drawing on his community organizing skills, traveling the country, listening to people. And can you talk about how he moves into the electoral arena?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right, because it's the voter education project is his bridge into politics. You know, he gets to know all these politicians on his travels, you know, among them, a young Arkansas attorney general. He wasn't even governor yet, Bill Clinton. They meet and they both told me their accounts of their first meeting, you know, when Bill Clinton was maybe 32 and John Lewis, you know, not all that much older. So this kind of gives him an entree into Atlanta politics, into Southern politics. He runs actually the first time in 1977 for Congress. Andrew Young, the great, you know, advisor to Martin Luther King, has served representing Atlanta's 5th district, the first Black representative from Georgia. But he goes into the Carter administration when Carter becomes president. He becomes UN ambassador. The seat opens up. John Lewis runs. He doesn't win, but he finishes a very creditable second to a man named White Fowler, a white man who serves in the role for many years. And then Lewis serves in the Carter administration. He's at an agency called ACTION that oversees the Peace Corps and VISTA and volunteer groups, and then returns to Atlanta, where he goes on to the city council. It seems like kind of an odd choice, but he wants to get into politics, in part through the encouragement of his wife, Lillian, who really helped him develop the confidence to believe that he could be a successful politician, that he could run successfully and serve successfully. And so he gets into local politics, makes a name for himself, and that in turn leads to the opportunity to run for the 5th congressional seat again when White Fowler goes to run for the Senate. And so in 1986, Lewis has his second chance, which of course this time he wins.
And as a congressman, he served for quite a while, but because of who he was, what does he bring that makes him so successful?
Well, he really comes to learn that the moral authority that he has developed from his years in the movement, the admiration for his principle, his courage, his sort of standing up for what he feels is right, it gives him a lot of sway. Even when he's a junior congressman, people want to know, where does John Lewis stand on this issue? He has credibility when the Democrats are, say, arguing with President George Bush Sr. about the 1991 Civil Rights Bill. People forget George Bush, who has gotten this nice makeover in history, was the first president to veto a civil rights bill since Andrew Johnson in the 1860s. And Lewis has been tapped for the Democratic leadership. Tom Foley, who was Democratic Speaker of the House, understands that Lewis's moral authority can be useful to the Democrats. And so John Lewis can go into the White House now with the Democratic leadership visit and say to George Bush, you've got to stop demagoguing the country on the civil rights bill. You're calling it a quota bill. We've made clear this won't permit quotas. This is just a job fairness bill. And Bush eventually backs down and signs the bill the next time around. Maybe not only because of John Lewis, but John Lewis's moral authority plays a big role. And he realizes, I think, throughout his congressional years that he can leverage that respect that he has, that when he takes a stand, he's doing it for profound reasons. And that can be very influential with Democrats, but also at times with Republicans. He's quite good at working across the aisle. Some of his greatest achievements were resoundingly bipartisan ones. I have this really rich account of the creation of the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture, which John Lewis fought for 20 years. And he finally is able to achieve because he finds a Republican, a very conservative, religious man named Sam Brownback, who works with him hand in glove to put together the support to get this great museum built. So he really becomes quite effective as a politician, drawing on the strength of his years in the movement.
Can you talk about the craft of writing this? In the acknowledgement, you mentioned the scores of interviews you did. Can you talk a little bit about your process?
It was really great fun. I had been a journalist for several years before becoming an academic historian, and I still do a lot of journalism. And writing about a figure from the recent past, I was able to draw on both sets of skills, both kinds of sources in telling the life of John Lewis. So for the early years, the civil rights years, there's a great deal of archival material I was able to draw upon, a lot of which had never really been looked at before. And these included also some amazing oral histories that John Lewis himself gave in real time. You know, these date to the late 1960s, where in oral histories that took many hours, he went through sometimes day by day or week by week the events of the movement. And of course, I interviewed people from that period too. But then when it came to the congressional years and there was less archival material available, as a young man, kind of right out of college, I had worked as an assistant to Bob Woodward, who just would interview relentlessly in his books. And I found myself kind of channeling Woodward and doing, you know, every day I was like, well, I can do one more interview or schedule one more. I did something like 450 in total with 275 people or something like that. And, you know, it kind of snowballs. Each person has another source to tell you about. And you hear a story from a second vantage point and a third, and you understand what happened in the room at that time. And so it allowed me to tell stories, to describe scenes, to put things in their correct chronological order. So I really understood what was happening on a day-to-day basis. And the interviews also, you know, I interviewed staff, I interviewed friends, friends of Lillian's. It helped give me the texture of his personality, you know, his quirks, his likes, his dislikes. You know, he was a big Braves fan. He loved antiquing. He loved to dance. And getting different people at different points in his life to describe his somewhat awkward, but nonetheless kind of endearing style of dancing, you start to see the whole personality take shape over the course of a life. And so it was kind of the interplay of the archival material, and there's a great secondary literature, of course, on the civil rights movement, and then the interviews that kind of collectively brought it to this other level.
And it sounds like he was open to this book and worked with you.
Very much so. I mean, I really wanted his blessing to write it, both because I thought a publisher would be more likely to give me a contract, but also because I knew that having his support would make his friends and others more comfortable in speaking with me. You know, very sadly, he died fairly early in the process of my writing the book. So I had just one face-to-face meeting with him and then some phone interviews during the pandemic. And he was already suffering from cancer and receiving chemo treatment. So I couldn't, you know, go and sit with him in a time of pandemic. But we talked on the phone. I felt I got to know him a bit. But I really got to know him through all these other sources, whether it was videos of him, newspaper accounts, the archives, the interviews. And so I hope I've done justice to his life. I certainly feel like I got to know him, you know, maybe better than I know real life acquaintances of mine. It was that kind of immersion.
I really appreciate the breadth of the book and also kind of the timing of it now.
Yeah.
The book ends in 2020. He lived long enough to see the Black Lives Matter movement, but also to see the pushback.
Yeah.
And
the MAGA movement, right?
Right. And I thought it was fascinating that he's in a position of consoling younger people during that time. And that's something that I think is a parallel for right now. For people who wonder, well, how do you work through challenging times? And there's an example
yeah.
in terms of what he continued to do.
Yeah, I mean, after Trump's election in 2016, people almost kind of spontaneously turned to John Lewis for hope, for solace, for inspiration. He becomes kind of an antidote to Trump. You know, one account of a woman who is just feeling sick about Trump's election. She's walking through the Atlanta airport, and there's John Lewis getting a shoe shine. And he steps off the pedestal and comes and gives her a hug. And she tells a reporter, "I felt after that I could go on for the next 4 years." I mean, he had an almost spiritual or religious quality about him that he had accrued by that point in his life. And his memoir, which was written in the 90s, becomes a bestseller again. The graphic memoirs, the March books that some people will know that he had written, become bestsellers again. He's someone people turn to because he represents what this country can do to overcome its worst sides and who embodies its best democratic traditions. And so I think in dark times, in times where it looks like democracy is imperiled, where racial equality seems to be imperiled, Lewis can remind us that we've been here before, we've fought it before, we've overcome before. And I think, you know, today, I would imagine there are people who are looking for the same kind of hope or inspiration, and people will probably take away many different things from this book. But I think one thing they'll take away is that, you know, John Lewis did lead a life that showed people how to not only persevere, but to conquer some of these dark elements in our history and to push us toward a better place, what he liked to call the beloved community. So maybe this book can sort of play that role today. I don't know.
I think so. Thank you so much for this book and for sharing your thoughts about it with us.
Well, thank you, Kevin. It's great to talk to you about it.
To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. Alani Hodge created our theme music. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a fantastic day.